This is Don Hossig with Cancer Action News Network's Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. This morning, joining us from way across this great big country of ours, out in the western U.S., now there is looming a problem such as exists right now in the province of Alberta. Alberta is a province of great country of Canada. And that great country is headed down the hill fast because of what they're doing out there with the Alberta tar sands exploitation. Hey, John, how's it going?
Hey, it's going well. Thanks, Donald.
This is John Weisheit. Is that the proper way of pronouncing your name?
Yes, thank you very much. For
John Weisheit, Living Rivers. And he
yes.
has been in the news recently. I first discovered his name and his group, the Living Rivers Group, when I was in my, you know, email, and I'm seeing on the Yahoo News that I get this lead story for whatever day that was not long ago. It was about this tar sands mining in Utah. And I had been wondering when this was going to begin because I talked to people that are involved with the tar sands up in Canada, and they were saying that there were proposals and there was this movement in the U.S., but this is the most, you know, specific and detailed information that I have, you know, come across. And so when I saw it, I immediately read the, you know, the article, this AP article, and then I contacted John, and here he is today to speak to the listeners to this program. So introduce yourself. Tell us all about yourself, John.
Well, I live in Moab, Utah. We are a Colorado River town, very close to the border of Colorado. And we have national parks around here, such as Arches and Canyonlands. And I've been a river guide for over 30 years, and I've decided to become an activist because I'm firmly convinced that we're losing the Colorado River, especially its biological integrity. So I became the founder, one of the founders, and to the Waterkeeper Alliance in New York asked me to join their ranks. There's nearly 200 water keepers worldwide, and so I represent the Waterkeeper Alliance as the Colorado River Keeper.
Tell me, the Waterkeeper Alliance, this Waterkeeper's phrase has come up frequently in dealing with the tar sands there in Canada, and there's two groups that I'm just thinking about right as we speak. I have their contact information right now, and I do want to mention them so people keep these threads, you know, kind of joining together. And this water thing is very important considering the impacts of tar sands on water, on, you know, clean water. There's a group called Keepers of the Athabasca Watershed Society, and it's Jill Pittman. She's the coordinator for that. And she was so good in helping me find these other people there that deal with the tar sands on a daily, regular basis. Then there's Harvey Scott. He's with Keepers of the Athabasca Water Council. So there's I get confused with these similar type names, but Jill was telling me, this Jill Pittman, she was telling me about this conference that's held every summer someplace in North America that brings together these watershed keeper people. Is what you're talking about part of that?
Yes, this year's conference will be held in Chicago. Last year's was held in Baja California.
Okay, well, this is different then, because hers, the ones that she was telling me about, were taking place in these remote places up in Canada. They will go to these very remote, say, Indian villages or, you know, places where there's a big water issue, and they will gather there. I think sometimes they actually have to fly into these places because they don't have maybe the road access. But it was very interesting what you were saying about these gatherings they have, these watershed council, these keepers of these rivers. And that it's very cool, you know. So I think there's a lot of this going on. And I will gradually become an expert in it and keeping track of who's who. But I really suggest you contact this Janice Pittman. She is just so good. They have this gorgeous website. And they also, you know, she's got a lot of connections, and what they've learned about tar sands in Alberta. This has been going on for since the 1960s up there. So they've had a huge amount of experience in getting going an activism that would hopefully shut this down someday soon and at least get a moratorium on no more tar sands mines. But it's so out of control, this is not a hopeful, you know, matter right at the moment up there. But you never know when the good spirits and the good people are going to, you know, join forces and bring some huge changes really fast. So tell us about this Utah. What is the name? You know, what these proposals always have a name, you know, that people can Google or people can try to, like, get more information on. What is the name of this project?
Well, it's a tar sands strip mining project that is in a place called the Uinta Basin, and it's a part of it is actually a high plateau from elevations of 8,000 feet to 10,000 feet. So some of it, excuse me, is sagebrush, and some of it is actually forested with firs and pines and oak.
Okay.
And it's, I would call it probably the most uninhabited area. Excuse me, if I clear my throat. In the 48 states, and consequently, there's huge herds of deer and elk and even bison. And it's kind of a like the last functioning ecosystem in the Colorado Plateau, and all those are drainages. Excuse me?
And you said the, is it Uinta?
Uinta. It's a,
How do you spell that?
It's U-I-N-T-A.
Okay, just like
and
it sounds.
It's a word,
Uinta.
It's a Numic word. It's a word of the Ute tribe.
Okay. So, if people were to do a web search, like a Google of Uinta, comma tar sands or Uinta tar sands mine, they'd find this.
Well, actually, I would also insert in your search the name P.R. Springs.
P.R., like as Paul Robert Springs?
Yeah, like, or public relations.
Or public relations, there you go. P.R. Springs, okay.
Yeah, P.R. Springs.
Okay.
And it's on the border of Grand County and Uinta County. It actually straddles the two counties.
Okay.
And I live in Grand County.
And this is all near the Colorado River.
It's 30 miles from the Green River, which is the major tributary of the Colorado, and probably 30 miles from the Colorado River.
Okay.
But the drainages flow to the Green River.
Okay.
But they connect downstream in Canyonlands National Park before they enter Lake Powell.
Okay. So tell me, give us like this kind of broad brush strokes, but also enough detail that, you know, people get a clear picture of this. What is the proposal? What are they going to do?
Well, there's a sandstone, limestone layer of rock. It's not really old rock. It's actually rock that was in an intercontinental lake, something like the Great Salt Lake, a lake that doesn't have river access to the ocean. That's what the Colorado River used to do long and long ago. It just used to flow into a big, huge lake and evaporate.
Okay.
And in that was a bunch of detritus, wood, leaves, dead animals. This is what became the carbon basis for the dirty oil that they want to extract. So some of it is a shale, and some of it is a tarry sandstone, and it's interlayered. And what they need to do, and it's at the level of the surface, and it didn't used to be, but there's been so much erosion that it's now exposed in the atmosphere. So what they have to do is literally dynamite it all apart, and so that they can get to the individual layers. So there's going to be earth movers, dynamite drills, men. Using mechanical devices that require petroleum in vast numbers, as a matter of fact, which makes this a very expensive operation. And so then when they finally get to the ore bodies, they'll take that bitumen and sand, and then there's a processing plant on the facility, and they will use hot water and a solvent that is citrus-based, and they will mix the bitumen with these fluids so that it will separate, and then they can skim it. And then they need to put it into tanks and very quickly get it to Salt Lake City so they can process it before it gets gooey. So it has to be transported warm. And there's like 3-4 refineries in Salt Lake City, and they will convert it. I understand it will be kerosene, aircraft fuel, diesel. Those are the products.
Okay, and what were the name of those refineries?
You know,
there were three
really
what refineries?
You mean the oil refineries? And the
yeah, you said there were three something refineries?
Yes, but I don't know the name of them.
Oh, okay. So in other words...
They're processing tar sands, I believe, from Alberta.
There's
some existing pipelines in there that they
Okay. That's very interesting because, see, the way I understand this, the emissions to air from refining tar sands, you know, that's in crude, that starts out from the bitumen, the emissions to air are much worse than the emissions to air for refining the sweet petroleum crude that, you know, comes from the Middle East and it came from Texas and these various other places where it was a cleaner, you know, petrol fuel source. So if you guys have already been encountering some of these dirtier air emissions, this is something to be keeping in mind, because I've done a lot of work trying to figure out an estimate of how the emissions change. And within the past year, EPA was still saying, we have no data on this. And then they were pointing me to this expert, Canadian, I think it was Environment Canada person, that was up at some refineries in the Great Lakes Basin of Ontario, the province of Ontario, where some of the tar sands crude was coming to them being refined, and it was being done separately from the other crude, so they could have had data. And this guy, this government employee, would not return my phone calls and would not provide any light upon how the emissions change when you start refining the syn crude as compared to the the sweet petroleum crude. And there's also this whole matter. This is just complicated enough that there's a lot of room for cheating and deceiving on the part of the corporations and the government, because it's my understanding that some places they start right off, say the refinery is going to actually get bitumen to do the refining, starting with right there at those smokestacks. So they're going to be putting out a much worse emission than the refinery that is obtaining syncrude, which has already been upgraded and had some processing go on before it ever arrived at the refinery. So it's complicated enough that people have to really know what's being proposed. So what you're saying is there at this, you know, this PR Springs tar sands mine, they're going to do the cleaning, the washing, and then they're going to truck it into, you say it was Salt Lake City?
Yes.
Into Salt Lake City to then go ahead and they must have to do some upgrading, because this first upgrading step, this coking step where they get the SO2 out of it, that's a step before they ever, you know, do any other refining that takes place at a refinery or mm-hmm. The conventional oil refineries. And then there'll be all that refining. And see, the problem is this dirty oil, this dirty tar sand, the bitumen, in the Canadian matters, and I'm sure it's relatively similar in Utah, there's so many metals, so many other elements other than carbon in this dirty fuel source that it creates an emission that's much worse, because it is harder to get it refined, so there's more refining activity going on. But then all the time you're doing that refining activity, it's putting out this nastier mix of contaminants to the outdoor air supply. So we've always... A lot of people have been it's been a water issue for many, many of those who've been involved. And I see that. It's a very powerful water issue with this washing the tar out of the sand with hot water. Horrible. But there's also this huge air thing that isn't really getting much play, and I think that it is very important because, you know, refineries are already sick places. They already have, you know, neighborhoods around them. If there's any people around in the vicinity that are having bad health effects, I've heard this over and over again. And to just to bring in something and do it there, processing this tar sands sourced fuel, you know, fuel feedstock, that is going to make those places more toxic because they're going to put out, they're going to do a more refining. There's going to be more, and it's going to be worse chemicals. So it's just, it's pretty bad. You know, it's not just a water thing. It's a water thing and a big air pollution thing. So tell us more. Tell us more. How big is this mine going to be?
Well, the entire mining, excuse me, the entire mining facility is about 213 acres. They're going to start with a single pit of about 62 acres, which makes it appear that this is, you know, experimental. You know, you could call this a demonstration project. Is that what
they're calling it?
No, they don't actually call it that. And,
okay.
But
okay.
That's the appearance that I would
okay.
give it. But I know they're totally ambitious because they also have leases for 6,000 acres. And I also read a press release on their webpage that they would like to increase their leases to 30,000 acres.
Hmm.
So they're serious, but this is just for a very small project, you could say. As I mentioned, most likely some sort of demonstration project so that they can get investors. As far as we know, they don't really have the money that they need to start this operation in the first place. So it is very speculative,
okay,
in my opinion.
So tell me, what was the reception like when they, you know, tell us about how this came to be at the stage it's at right now. You know, they had to show up in town. They had to, like, start talking to government people. They had to take some steps to get – it's my understanding now that they have obtained the permit for doing this. So, basically, there's nothing standing in their way of doing it, right?
Right. It was relatively secret. I did not even know this was happening. And there were some environmental groups that did catch this, and they did file a intervention. It's called an administrative appeal with the Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining. And there was a settlement, and the settlement is that you need to broadcast this out and send it back out to the public so that they can become more involved with this process because this is a pretty important deal. So that's
certainly
when we heard about it. It was kind of the second round. And
okay,
that's when I wrote my comments to get standing so that I could file an administrative appeal, which is what I did.
And how did that turn out?
Well, it was successful. So we had, in July 2010, we had what was called an informal hearing. Living Rivers and Peaceful Uprising jointly attended and participated, and that was an appeal before the executive director of the agency. And they denied our appeal. So the next process is to file a direct appeal to the board. And to do that, you need to have representation by a legal firm. So my legal assistance came voluntarily from Western Resource Advocates, which is a nonprofit organization of attorneys, and they're handling my case for Living Rivers.
Yes.
And we've also since then filed another appeal, and this is with an agency called the Utah Division of Water Quality. And the reason why is they bought off on the water quality mandates of the permit. Obviously, UDOGM has to refer to Air Quality Board, for example, the Water Quality Board. And so these agencies participated, and we think that they glanced over this. And so we think it needs more review, and that's what our challenge is, especially as
okay.
it relates to pollution of air and water.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting to see how that comes along. Up in Alberta, the government has been so awful. They basically just turn away from the pollution problems and make these crazy, absurd claims that there's no effect, no damage to the environment, whether it be water or air. And yet the people that live there see these just horrendous changes that no one could miss. There's a lot of sickness in this Indian village, this Fort Chipewyan, that's downstream on the Athabasca River from the big tar sands concentrations of the, you know, strip mines at Fort McMurray. And I've interviewed Dr. John O'Connor. He's an MD that takes care of the First Nations people there at Fort Chipewyan. And he said they had very good health records, and it was very useful to look at the changes in the health that took place over the course of these decades when the tar sands activity became more and more of an impact on river quality, river water quality. And they found a large number of cholangiosarcoma there, which is a very rare cancer of the bile duct. And it was just so interesting to hear how that he was comparing this to the data from earlier, you know, an earlier time when these First Nations people were not being impacted by the tar sands. A lot of disease there now that didn't exist there several decades ago. So tell me, I think when we spoke previously, you had mentioned that there were some First Nations that have a role to play here. What's going on with that?
Well, there's a reservation. It's called the Uinta Ouray, and they are part of the Ute tribe. They're Numic-speaking people. They came from Colorado. There was a treaty in southwestern Colorado called the Bruno Treaty, and they actually diminished their land and relocated them into Utah. And they, it's a large reservation, and actually they have a considerable amount of oil shale and tar sands on their land as well.
Okay.
And so there, I think we can say that the traditional people would be concerned about this development. But then again, we could also say that there are tribal interests there that want to see this develop so they can make income.
Right. Yeah, it's a unfortunate reality that they've been cheated so long and have struggled so long to have, you know, something close to a satisfactory level of, you know, the material needs being satisfied. And then some of them, they're not, you know, they struggle with kind of keeping their separateness from this really material culture that we have. And some of them, I'm sure, see parts of that are appealing to them for one reason or another. And there's just this problem of the First Nations people being so, they started out in such a good place, but they just kind of gradually became more and more like the European, the Western civilization. And it's, you know, I'm sure that what you're stating about there being these two attitudes there on this, you know, this native land about tar sands exploitation. And I'm
sure
see exactly
what's
what
happening on. Well, I was just going to say that's what's happening on Navajo and Hopi land in Black Mesa as far as developing the coal reserves there. Same problem.
Okay. So I don't see, this is the thing. Isn't it amazing? Our country is so huge, and I consider myself to be really, you know, concerned about all these environmental issues, and yet I have never spoken with someone before in my life about, say, coal mining on First Nations lands in any place on earth, you know, let alone my own country. It's just, you know, and it's also interesting, and there's so much power and, you know, potential for learning something and growing in, you know, these very important matters. I don't know, I guess maybe we better tell me a little about that. So as far as the coal mining with these First Nations that you just named, how, you know, is that in Colorado? Is it in Utah? Where is that at?
Well, it's in north central Arizona. The Navajos have the largest reservation in the United States. They're also the most populous nation. And the Hopis are wrapped around in the center and on high mesas. And so Black Mesa is a Cretaceous deposit of coal, very similar to the Uinta Basin, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
So it's being strip mined.
Oh, wow.
And it's damaging water resources. And the coal is used to power Navajo Generating Station near Lake Powell, for example. It goes to other places. There's several mines. There's several steam plants
okay.
in northern Arizona. And that's where the coal goes to. It's delivered usually by train and trucks and pipelines.
How does the pipeline work?
Well, that
like a slurry?
Actually has been the contentious issue. They don't do this anymore. A lawsuit was filed, and the Hopis and the Navajos prevailed. They shut down the pipeline because it was depleting their aquifer. They were using fresh potable water mixed with a crushed slurry to send it down to Laughlin, Nevada for
wow.
a power plant that was owned by the Los Angeles Power District.
Huh.
And they shut it down.
That's a wonderful accomplishment. And it's, you know, it's just, and then we're just right back to tar sands, how they use that wonderful clean water from the boreal forests up there, the pristine boreal forests there in Alberta, taking that wonderful, precious, clean water and turning it into this soup of horribly toxic chemicals by washing that tar out of that sand. What an awful thing to do with water. And tell me, where's the water going to come from to do this at PR Springs?
Well, that's another reason why I think this is a speculative adventure. So, you know, as I said, you know, this mine is at 8,000 feet, and the Green River and the White River, which are the closest rivers, are 30 miles away, and they're also about 4,500 feet in elevation, so there's no way they're going to be able to pump water that distance that high. So they're forced to use groundwater. And the wells are of unknown quantity. They don't even really know how long they'll last. It's very likely that they will mine them and have to drill a new well in another location, and so it'll be a repetitive sequence of finding wells, moving pipelines for the lifespan of this oil project. But it is considered Colorado River water because groundwater and surface water are linked, and it's
yep.
all part of the Colorado River Compact. So they do need to get water from Utah's allocation.
Okay.
And we're having a problem here generally in the Colorado River Basin, which is we're running out of water.
Yeah.
The conditions of Lake Powell and Lake Mead, the low reservoir conditions, is spoken of in the press all the time, from the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal. And so we're definitely an area of water scarcity.
Right.
Where the folks in Los Angeles and Denver or Phoenix or Las Vegas, they need their water supplies to be reliable. And so more of these projects, especially if they're dubious, especially if they could cause pollution, are a risk that needs to be considered. And
right.
That's why this main reason, also climate change, is why I am intervening in this, is because they're going to destroy a watershed and make our water scarcity even worse just to manufacture and process a dirty oil that's going to make our atmosphere even worse and our living conditions even worse. And it's like, why, you know, my question is why do this? Why even go this? Why open up this box? You're going to
because it's possible.
Regret doing
it's, just
this.
It's just because it can be done and there's a dollar to be made at it. You know, even if it was just 50 cents he made at it. This is the horrible thing about capitalism and about technology and about the last of the easier to obtain fuel sources and about greed and about people's inability to conserve and about, you know, huge numbers of human beings on the planet and about climate change. It's just amazing. You know, this does not work. This does not work doing this with this. Money has, it's so powerful. It just, I hope people will discover that it's too powerful for people to handle, you know, and just to put at risk all the things that we need so much that we never paid for before. And now as they disappear because we've turned everything into money, wow, what a mess. Yeah, let's go to another angle of this, another aspect of this. Where are they going to put the toxics, you know, the, where are they going to put this stuff that they get out from the citrus-based water, you know, concoction that they're using to wash the tar out of the sand? What are they going to do with the dirty water?
Well, they are going to recycle the water and the chemical as much as possible, but they can't get it all.
Right.
It's not 100% recoverable because sand and clay is porous, and so a lot of the water and chemical will be retained in the waste sand, which will be put into unlined pits, the pits that they expose to get the ore body. And so that means, of course, they say they're going to groom them, and they're going to put topsoil on top of them and vegetate them.
Well, that doesn't fix it.
And, well, no, if anybody who lives in the Colorado Plateau, there's one thing that that is known by all. One, we don't have topsoil. Two, we don't have water. So their ambition is kind of exposing them for that they don't really know what they're doing here, and they have no familiarity with the geography. But anyway, you know, we get these huge thunderstorms in the Colorado Plateau, and sometimes the side canyons will flow greater than the Colorado and the Green River combined, you know. And so these cloudbursts are going to percolate through these waste piles, erode the topsoil away that they disturb, filter through the waste project, pick up these chemicals, and even, but you know, because they're citrus, they sound like they're biodegradable, but you know, they're not. This, they have the ability to melt tar, so you know, there's some toxicity here. It's going to.
And what about all the metals? That we certainly, metals like arsenic and cadmium and chromium, these cancer-causing metals, and metals are, they're forever. They're not. We deal a lot with persistent organic pollutants like the dioxins and furans and PCBs and brominated flame retardants. But we always point out that metals are an element, and that means they're forever, even more forever than plutonium. These, you know, metal is a metal forever. It doesn't break down. It might change oxidation state, but the arsenic and cadmium and chromium and nickel and lead that they bring up and put in those waste pits once they've, you know, washed it out of the tar sand, that will be there in those waste pits forever. And like you say, it doesn't stay there. It doesn't stay there.
Exactly. So that's the dilemma. You know, these toxins are going to get into the water supply. They're going to flow to the Green River. You know, we have endangered fish species in the Green River. It goes on downstream, and it ends up in our lettuce in the agricultural fields of California, and it goes to 25 million people, including Mexico, for drinking water. So...
Too little water to do this to it.
Yeah.
So how is the activism coming along? Do you see a growing, you know, number of people who want to put the effort in to oppose this?
Yes. There are climate justice activists in Salt Lake City who don't want this project to happen because they're going to have to breathe the dirty air. And... you know, one of the reasons why the Colorado River is in reduction is because of climate change caused by carbon dioxide emission. So it's kind of like a situation of shooting yourself in your foot. So, you know, there are definitely people who are in Utah who are aware of this and they want to make a difference. And I think that they would even go as far as to put their bodies in front of the bulldozers. I'm quite certain that will happen if our litigation and doesn't work. But you have to realize that, you know, Utah wants to develop its energy resources, and they don't really seem to care what the costs are, which indicates to me that this is all being driven by greed.
There you are.
And
there it is. There it is, that word again. Yep.
Well, it's unfortunate because this is a Mormon state. You know, these are a Christian-based group of people that are very hierarchical in Utah society, especially in the politics. And so, you know, they've always been known for their excellent land management capabilities, but all of that's gone. They don't believe in these things anymore. They just want, they've become corporatists. They want money. They're greedy. And I find that extremely unfortunate.
Very, very horribly unfortunate. It's cool the way there is a element of that issue being raised up in the Alberta tar sands. One of the bishops, I think he was a bishop, I can't remember his name for this minute, but he wrote this paper about the lack of morality that is evidenced by the exploitation of tar sand, you know, to produce energy for our societies. And it was very well, you know, kind of responded to by the public and the news media. And maybe it sounds to me like your situation there with this state of Utah that has a long history of the Mormon religion, you know, these religious leaders that certainly one would hope would have better morality than, say, just the average political leaders. Like, that's a very potent issue to raise as far as the lack of morality that's involved in doing this dirty fuel in these days of the earth, you know, just disintegrating in its special basic ecological systems and physical entities that we need so much, the water, the air, the land, the you know, the wildlife, all these things that are just kind of like breaking down. And there's these catastrophes like the BP oil spill and that horrible nuclear problem with the tsunami in Japan and the nuclear reactors. There just seems like, isn't it enough, you know, that people have done all these horrible things? You think they'd have at least morality enough to, like, look at it and wake up. Amazing.
Exactly.
So maybe there's some bishops out there. Hopefully there's some bishops out there, or I guess it wouldn't be bishops in this. Well, what do they call the Mormon church leaders?
They're called bishops.
Yeah, well, hopefully there's some Mormon bishops that'll have the courage and integrity that this Canadian bishop had. And maybe it'd be nice. I'll track it down and send you the letter he wrote, and maybe that will inspire some Mormon bishop to write something similar, you know.
Oh, please do. I'd be happy to share.
Okay. Is there anything more that jumps into your mind about this?
Well, it's just not Utah. It's also Colorado, and it's also Wyoming. That's where the Green River Formation spreads out through. It's a tri-state area, and they say there's as much oil here as there is in Saudi Arabia, but to do it, they literally just have to just destroy this entire landscape.
Isn't that crazy? You know, how do they dare?
Well, it would be just like what's happening in Appalachia. So if you are angered about that and you find that to be a total issue of injustice, that's what's going to happen here. And so there is a federal involvement. You know, what's happening at PR Springs involves the state of Utah because it's land that's owned by the state of Utah.
Okay.
But you have to realize in the West we have huge tracts of federal land that belong to everybody in all the 50 states and all, including Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico and the world.
Right.
It's public land. And so they have to go through NEPA or the National Environmental Policy Act. And so April 14th, last week, the Bureau of Land Management, which manages public lands in the West, issued a Federal Register notice that there are going to be an EIS on development of tar sands and oil shales. So this is an opportunity for the public to voice their concerns and write
yes.
good comments, and I would invite them to just go to our webpage, and there's a link there on the left-hand side to read the federal notice and to get involved, and our webpage is livingrivers.org.
Okay, livingrivers.org, and this is John Weisheit. He's a Colorado, is it a Colorado or a Green River guide, or both of them?
River guides on the Colorado River do the San Juan, they do the Yampa, they do the Green. There's a lot of tributaries here, and they're
okay.
All exciting whitewater trips, and I take people down the river.
Cool. Yeah, my mom wants to see the Grand Canyon, so I'm on my way out there. I'm going to be in Montana. I told myself I was going to be there in May, but it's not looking all that hopeful the way, see, I am an activist, and we have a lot of, we like to do this right at the grassroots. So we have this huge cancer problem here in northern New York State. This is up in the St. Lawrence River Valley. It's St. Lawrence County. And being downwind and downstream from the Ohio River Valley and the Golden Triangle over there in Toronto, you know, kind of Windsor-type area of the province of Ontario, we get a huge amount of air pollution that is not acknowledged. We get the St. Lawrence River is the sore of the Great Lakes, and you know what that means with the huge industrial base that's around the Great Lakes and all the agriculture as well. So we have very high cancer rates that are the proof of this. And we decided we're going to do something about that. In January 2000, we got our group going. And the place we have come to is we go right directly to town boards, and they're all over the place. You know, we have numerous towns in our counties. We go to the town boards and we get them to do resolutions that are about pollution and cancer and doing something about it, basically telling people the names of the chemicals, how they get exposed, how they can reduce the pollution, and how they can avoid the exposure that's in existence right now. And that's going good, and I'm excited about it, so who knows when I'll actually get to Montana. But I get a van sitting out there that my brother left on his way to Alaska. I'm going to get my hands in that van and start doing some. I want to see for myself those tar sands up there in Alberta, and I want to see what's going on there in Utah. And this thing with that shale gas, that horrible shale gas that they're doing, they're just ruining Colorado and all these other places. I saw that Gaslands movie that Josh Fox had done. And mm-hmm. to see that BLM land where they have all those horrible gas wells and all the air pollution and water pollution that comes from those awful things, wow. I get some things I got to see.
Yes, and it's affecting the Colorado River, unfortunately, and it's ruining our air quality. You might be interested to know that the attorneys that represented the victims of 9/11 have filed a class action suit with the state of Colorado citizens who are suffering from air pollution. And so this is kind of exciting. So it is being addressed in the court system, but what we really need is we need stronger regulations and enforced regulations from the federal government and the state governments, because we're getting lax. We're going back to the way it was in the 60s with dirty
right.
air and dirty water. And,
yep.
And we need to desperately do something about this.
And the only way to prevent that is for every person to care. You know, have you ever heard that Nickelback song, If Everyone Cared?
Perhaps.
That is the most awesome song, Lisa. Yeah, like the chorus is, if everyone cared and nobody cried, if everyone loved and nobody lied, if everyone shared and sold their pride, would we see a day when nobody died? That is such an awesome song. That's kind of like our song, you know, this Cancer Action New York's. That's our song. And I told people last night at an open mic I was doing, I said, you know, the war on cancer was declared by Nixon in 1971. That's where the National Cancer Act dates from. That's where the National Cancer Program got going. If everybody had cared back then and continued to care all those decades, 40 years, 71 to 2011, 40 years, there'd be no more cancer, believe me. There would not have. That was all about preventing the exposure to the chemicals that cause cancer. And the chemical corporations co-opted it, turned it into screening and early detection, calling that prevention. This is it's an indictment of human beings that such good intentions will be turned into such a bad result, because cancer incidence rates are going up, not down. Mortality's gone down a little bit, but the causes of cancer are worse, and there's more cancer getting caused than ever before. And then they talk about doing these tar sands and this shale gas. This is crazy. There's a lot of insanity involved in this, believe me. The insanity caused by greed.
Yes.
Well, John, it's been great talking to you. I feel the kind of like the vibe of a fellow spirit, you know. It's cool.
Well, thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you got in the news, you know. It's so cool. See, that's the thing. The corporate media, that's why we do Cancer Action News Network, because we could not. We went so far, you know, with our opposition to big, you know, industrial proposals for this reindustrialization of the St. Lawrence River Valley. We stopped a $136 million chipboard OSB mill from being plunked down in our county. And in doing that, we became the only ones on a blacklist that is, you know, they're perfectly willing. They'll just say it, you know, the news media up here, it's like this very monopolistic types of endeavor, this Watertown Daily Times and these North Country newspapers. Their reporters say to us, there's a blacklist, Cancer Action New York's on it. We aren't allowed by our, you know, our managing editor to write anything about what you guys do. So we started our own news. But you're fortunate.
Okay.
You don't seem to be on any blacklist.
Well, I do have a web page that people can read an article and they can learn more about the area through photos and maps and documents.
Okay.
And it is the web page for my, I guess it's my blog, is called onthecolorado.org, one word. And they'll see my tar sands article there and also the other threats that we're dealing with here with on the Colorado Plateau.
Okay, so on the Colorado.org, all one word.
Yes.
Okay,
yep.
We'll check it out.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. Yeah, have a great weekend.
You too, Donald.
Viva the environmental revolution.
Right on. Take
yep.
care.
Yeah, we'll see you.
Bye-bye.
This has been Don Hossig with Cancer Action News Network. This is an environmental revolution, a good revolution of people caring. You know, if everyone starts caring, we'll get this right. We will have another program for you soon.